court in all of history, William Jennings Bryant, a three-time candidate for president on one hand, and Clarence Darrow, the greatest trial lawyer of his time, on the other, about the teaching of evolution in a high school. And in one scene, a young woman who had idealized Bryant in the film, he's called Matthew Harrison Brady, played in remarkable fashion by Frederick March. She is talking to Brady's wife, and both of them are older, and he has disillusioned her, and now she hates him. And his wife said, "Look, youth can be very pure. At one point you thought he was an angel, and now you think he's a devil, but he's neither one. He's just a man with all of the complexity and ambiguity that goes with that." And you realize when you hear that, that in some ways that encapsulates part of the message of the movie, which is that the human motivation to totalize, to make everything one, to idealize, to obliterate distinctions is very deep in us and carries forth not only in the way that we look at individuals, but at cultures, at history, and certainly as Jews at our own situation. I began with a movie because I want to talk about movies. Not in general, but two in particular that illustrated this for me. A few weeks ago, I saw a movie that, if it is still playing, I recommend to you, although not so that you'll have a good time. It's called Aftermath. And it is about what happens in a Polish village after the Second World War and after the fall of communism. What you may not know, and what the movie itself I don't think identifies, is it's based on a book by a Polish historian who teaches here in the United States named Jan Gross. What happened was that Gross examined the records of a small town. I'm going to try to pronounce it for you, but those of you who speak Polish will correct me later. Jedwabne, in Poland, where it was always said that what had happened was the Germans came in and they killed all the Jews, because the Polish narrative of themselves was the Poles as victims. And in fact, the Poles were victims. They weren't only the victims of Nazis, but Poland was a victim of history. Poland has an unhappy history for a culture with a long, long tradition of poetry and self-reflection. Poland has been conquered again and again. And so the story was the Nazis came in and did all these terrible things. But Gross, uncovering the records of the city, proved that in fact it was the Polish villagers who killed the Jews, not the Nazis. And the book caused a storm of controversy throughout Poland, as you might imagine, with people lining up on all sides. And the movie has done the same. Because when you see the movie, and I've now told you the basic theme of it, the villagers are portrayed as coarse and brutish and narrow and nasty and deeply anti-Semitic. Except, of course, for the two heroes. And you walk out of that movie, and it's very hard not to totalize. There were 3 million Jews, actually a little more than 3 million, in Poland before the war, and after the war, fewer than 100,000. Now, no conquering army can achieve that sort of all near total eradication without the cooperation of the population. And indeed, the enthusiasm with which many Poles turned in their neighbors, or literally had a hand in killing their neighbors, is now beyond dispute and is part of the searing memory of anybody who not only cares about the fate of humanity, but who tries to understand how people could be friendly one day and murderous the next. But then I saw another movie that some of you saw with me. It was made by one of our own, Dina Kadisha Aspen, and it's called The Revival of Jewish Life in Poland. And remarkably, as paradoxical and almost oxymoronic as that title sounds, there is a revival of Jewish life in Poland. There are small green shoots that are coming up from the stony, unfertile ground of Polish history, at least for Jews. And you remember that if there were 3 million Jews in Poland before the war, that there had to be a reason why all those Jews were in Poland and not elsewhere. Why weren't those Jews in France or in England? And the answer is because Poland was welcoming to Jews on a relative scale for a very long time. That there was, in fact, a Jewish-Polish symbiosis that was hardly perfect and was filled with difficulty and historical tragedy, but was real. That's why 3 million Jews lived there, when they didn't live, for example, in Spain or in England, which had a wholesale expulsion earlier on of the Jewish people. And Dina, along with the joint sponsored by the Joint Distribution Committee, goes around Poland and speaks to those who are seeking to revive Jewish life in Poland, and all of a sudden, it becomes the character of Matthew Harrison Brady. That is, it's complicated. Is there anti-Semitism in Poland? That qualifies as a rhetorical question. But guess what? When they take surveys of anti-Semitism in Poland, it's about the same as you get in France. 30-40% express some kind of anti-Semitic stereotype. But now listen to what that means, that over half don't. Now, if you find that shocking, it's because we do still have this totalizing tendency. What is it to be a Pole? It is to hate Jews. What is it to be a Muslim? It is to want to destroy Jews. And the problem with stereotypes is that they're based on facts very often. Not always, but very often. It's not as though there's nothing about them that is true, but then you have to do the very difficult thing of holding two contraries in your mind at the same time, which is that the Jews of Poland were subject to wholesale destruction with the cooperation of the Poles, and that Poland had a history of welcoming Jews and now is going through the kind of self-examination that other cultures, by the way, after World War II, notably Japan, never did. And that other cultures that persecuted Jews, like, for example, Austria, still have not done. And then all of a sudden, what was easy and monochromatic becomes fractured and full of subtle shading. As some of you know, this week, the American Studies Association decided they were going to boycott Israel. Now, I don't know how many products the American Studies Association buys. And in fact, if you look at the numbers, there were some 1,200 people at that meeting. It's a union for the professors, for university professors who teach American studies, which means basically that about 700 people voted for this boycott. So it's not exactly sweeping the land. But it's symbolic and it's important and it says something about what's going on university campuses. So I wrote an editorial about it. Lots of other people wrote editorials about it. But then the other side started to come in. Brandeis withdrew from the American Studies Association. Won't have anything more to do with it. And I'm proud to say Sure, you can absolutely applaud Fred Lawrence, after all, who has been on this pulpit, the president of Brandeis, but I got another one for you. And having been born in Harrisburg, I'm very proud of this. Penn State Harrisburg said they are withdrawing too from the American Study Council. Now, why? I don't know. As I recall, in Harrisburg, we have a pretty small Jewish community. It was a nice one. Of course, I left at 10, so I'm not sure I could evaluate the Jewish community of Harrisburg that well, but still. But I bet you anything that 10 times as many people heard about the boycott as heard about Brandeis. Because the boycott gives us a narrative we can hang on to. Ah, you see, university professors hate Israel and this is what they do. But it's not university professors. By the way, the vote was 2/3 of the American Studies Association, so even in the climate of the American Studies Association, 1/3 of them voted against it. And so you have to balance. And you have to appreciate the fact that as soon as you make simple, declarative, unnuanced, unfootnoted statements about any group, the exception is waiting in the wings to prove you wrong. There's no blanket statement that you can make about anything significant that is liable to prove always true. Some Jews are not argumentative. No blanket statement works. And that reality is hard for us to hold on to when it's something that we're passionate about. So you'll see, in fact, outside, that AIPAC is pushing more sanctions on Iran, and some people are arguing for it, and some people are arguing against it. And AIPAC, after careful deliberation once more, but here again, on Iran, as you know, the issue is complicated. Nobody knows for sure what will work or what won't work. Nobody knows certainly how to accomplish the end that everyone desires, which is that the most troubling state in the most troubled region in the world not acquire the worst weapon in the world. And the problem with totalizing is not just that you say things that are almost certainly untrue, but that you make yourself unable to listen to anyone who advances the opposite argument. Anybody walking out of Aftermath thinks the idea of a revival of Jewish life in Poland is a joke. But it is, in fact, happening. And when they ask the rabbi, when Dina asks him in the movie, how many Jews are there in Poland? He said, I can say with absolute confidence, without fear of being contradicted, that no one has any idea. But he said, I can say with equal confidence that next year there will be more of them than there are this year. That's an extraordinary thing. When Moshe is born, and he's put into the Teva, a word used only twice in all of the Tanakh, it's used for Noah's Ark and for Moses' basket, because Moses sits in the basket that will, in its way, redeem the world, just as Noah sat in the ark that would redeem the world. Pharaoh's daughter comes down to the Nile. And then we read in this morning's parsha, Vehine na'ar bocheh, and behold, a child crying. And the rabbis ask, why behold? After all, you hear children crying. You don't see them crying first. First you hear them. But they said, no, Moshe was wise beyond his years and knew how dangerous it was to cry out loud. So it was a silent cry. It was atzur mima'amakei halev. It was stopped up in the depths of his heart. And you think to yourself, what was that cry about? What was Moses' cry? And I want to propose to you that it was about everything. That Moses gave a comprehensive cry to the world because he was about to enter a society laced with brutality, but at the same time, he was going to bring them hope. His people were slaves, but they were slaves that suddenly were dusted with possibility. They were people who were desperate and almost hopeless, but they were people who were about to find God. And Moses, he cried for all of it, for the pain and the joy, for the tragedy that was and the Torah that through him would be. If you want to live a rich life, a full life, a true life, you can't live a life of only one view. You have to see both sides. You have to appreciate that human beings are complex, and if we're complex, then just imagine how complicated is the one who created us in God's image. That the world is full of unexpected happenings, surprises, and that most of them spring from the unpredictability of the divided human heart. So read and listen and think of all the different sides. Pay attention to that silent cry of Moses, because in that cry is all the pathos and all the beauty of the world into which he was born. And all the pathos and the beauty of our world, too. And if we want to make the music better, then we have to listen to the entire symphony. Shabbat Shalom.